Thank you. Thank you very much, David, for that presentation, which I, for one, found extremely informative and clear, if I may say so, for somebody like me who's not an economist or an expert, whatever, but being a politician who has to address these issues, which I suppose I certainly am. The next presentation is a two-hander, if I may describe it as such. Charles Normand and Anne Nolan have a presentation entitled The Impact of the Economic Crisis on Health and the Health System in Ireland. I'll ask Anne Nolan to kick off. Anne, thank you very much.
First, thank you very much, Minister. As you said, it's a two-hander, so I'm going to start off and Charles is going to finish the presentation and summarise. So this is part of a larger project that we've been working on. It's also part of a much larger European project that we're involved in, looking at the impact of the economic and financial crisis both on health and also on health systems across the EU. So I have to acknowledge our colleagues in the European Observatory on Health Systems and Policies and in the WHO, and also some other colleagues in Trinity who have been working on this with us. The context for this piece of work, I don't need to go into this in any great detail with this audience, but obviously there have been very substantial health system pressures in Ireland over the last number of years. The foremost and most obvious one are the large real declines in public health expenditure that we've experienced over the last number of years. So what we've put up here are the nominal and real expenditure levels for public health expenditure since 2000. So you can see over the period 2000 to the peak in 2009, health expenditure essentially doubled in real terms. Since then, there's been about £1.5 billion taken out of the public health system. That's about a 10 percentage point drop in nominal terms. So it's a very significant amount of resources out of the health system in a relatively short period of time. Apart from that, there are also other pressures on the health system, some of them external and some of them internal and subject to more policy influence by policymakers. So in terms of external pressures, we have demographic change. There has been population growth right through this period, as you'll know from the recent census figures and also population estimates after that. The Irish population is ageing as well, although not quite as quickly as some other European countries, and we also have the highest fertility rate in the EU. So there are constraints in terms of that. There are also more internal pressures and things that maybe we can do something about. In terms of the public health system, there's been documented limited capacity in certain sectors, so for example mental health services. Over time we've had numerous reports which have looked at the mix between acute hospital services and the sort of the more weaker primary and community care services in the Irish health system. Then there's also what we term the demand-led scheme. So these are principally the general medical services scheme in the Irish system and the medical card scheme. And obviously with rising unemployment and falling incomes, that has increased medical and the card numbers and subsequently put pressure on the system. There's also traditionally been high costs in the Irish public health system in terms of salaries, in terms of pharmaceuticals, and Paul will speak afterwards about some of the progress that has been made in terms of pharmaceuticals. And then finally, there are also the recent programme for government commitments in relation to universal health insurance and extension of free GP care. So the approach that's taken in this paper and in the project more widely is to look at the current situation with regard to a number of different policy levers and to also look at the potential policy responses and look at the experience across other European countries with regard to those policy responses and to evaluate their applicability to the Irish case. And the three areas that we look at are the level and mix of statutory resources for health, health cover and health services efficiency. And then the second part of the project then is looking at the wider implications, both of these health system responses, but also the financial and the economic crisis on population health. And David has gone into some detail there on the literature surrounding this. There's obviously lots of literature from previous crises right across the world on this issue. And we've gathered some data in relation to mortality, self-assessed health and health behaviours, perhaps too early to make any definitive conclusions in that regard. And then finally, we're going to sum up. So in terms of the level and mix of statutory resources for health, by statutory resources for health, what I mean are payments that are prepaid and mandatory. Okay? So essentially what we're talking about here are general taxation, either direct or indirect, payroll taxes or social health insurance payments, which tend to be more common in other European countries, and then also in some cases mandatory health insurance, as we have in the Dutch healthcare system. And there's a number of principles underlying statutory resources for health and the collection of these resources. Obviously, you want to try and ensure that they're at an adequate level, okay, that they provide sufficient resources for the system you're trying to fund. There's also issues associated then with stability and predictability of these resources. Obviously, certain forms of, for example, taxation are more predictable and less subject to fluctuations in the economic cycle. So, for example, stamp duties would be the big example here. There's also issues then associated with fairness and equity, okay, how progressive or how regressive, for example, certain forms of taxation are. Also issues then associated with transparency, administrative costs, and whether people can see how their contributions are being spent. And then there are finally, there's other consequences or other factors that are associated with how resources are gathered. So, for example, with payroll taxes, there may be concerns about wage competitiveness or labour competitiveness and wider costs more generally. So I'm just going to very briefly go through the sort of the current situation in Ireland and what's been happening over the last number of years. Now, this is quite an interesting graph because it shows the proportion of public health expenditure in Ireland as a proportion of total health expenditure, and it also graphs the situation across, so this is an average for the OECD. And you'll see that contrary to what's been happening in the OECD, what's happened in Ireland in recent years is the proportion of total health expenditure that's accounted for by the public system has actually declined, and it's gone below the OECD average. So this is consistent with what we know in terms of increasing reliance on out-of-pocket payments and private health insurance payments. So obviously, there may be other issues in terms of private health costs that may be driving this figure. In terms of, though, the public health expenditure as a percentage of total public expenditure, the situation shows that has changed very slightly. It's essentially stayed around 25% over the period of the crisis. And that's consistent, really, with, I suppose, the health system. You know, it cannot observe the sorts of cuts it had to keep its proportion of total public expenditure that it would have had pre the crisis. So the policy options that have been identified across the EU, some of these are obviously more realistic than others and more applicable to the Irish case. Obviously, there's the keep going, continue with budget reductions. There's the option then of earmarking resources for health. So within existing funds, certain resources are targeted specifically for the health system. Now, obviously, other government departments may take issue with that, but it has been done in other countries, and there are certain taxation sources that can be earmarked for health. There's also issues then in terms of introducing a new statutory source of revenue. For example, a payroll tax has been mooted in certain countries, but experience with that has shown that it tends to be associated with offsetting reductions in general taxation, and there can be concerns over adequacy and stability, so they're associated with pro-cyclical fluctuations. A new source of statutory revenue then in terms of what we call sin taxes or fat taxes could be introduced. But saying that, the primary objective associated with these is essentially behavioural change rather than the revenue-raising component. And there has been some work done in this regard in the Irish context, which David has been involved in, looking at a sugar sweetened drinks tax, and there was a report published in that regard in Ireland in last year. So in terms of health cover then, essentially there's three aspects to public health cover to think about. The first is the breadth of cover, so essentially who is covered by the public system. Secondly then we think about the scope of services, so what is covered, so what are people entitled to as part of the public health system. And then finally there's the depth aspect to it, so essentially how much of the cost of the public healthcare is covered, are there user fees. And basically this mix of breadth, scope and depth of health cover can be designed in very different ways, and there can be different trade-offs between different aspects of this. And essentially it has to conform with various principles. So in terms of alleviating or exacerbating fiscal pressure, okay, so for example, if you have reliance on public health or private health expenditure or private health insurance that may have tax relief, there may be consequences there in terms of fiscal pressure. There's also ways in which, for example, user fees can be designed to strengthen health system performance. So, for example, that you're encouraging the use of generic pharmaceuticals, for example, and associated efficiencies. Current situation in Ireland, I don't need to tell anybody in this room here, we have a very complex system of public health care entitlements. Essentially, there's two categories of entitlements, full medical card and those without. We also have a GP visit card system, and then there's other entitlements. One thing that's interesting and that's quite unique in the European context, in the Irish system, is the role of private health insurance. In terms of overall financing, it counts for quite a small proportion, but it has quite significant impacts in terms of equity and efficiency. I suppose the main point to make here, though, is that there have been quite substantial recent declines in cover, and recent declines in cover differentiated by the age of those that are covered. So you'll see there, just we've put up the proportion of the population that are covered by category one, so essentially the medical card. You'll see there that that's really follows the economic cycle. Okay, so as incomes have fallen and unemployment has increased from 2008, you'll see there are large increases in the medical card proportion. So the proportion of the population now that has a medical card or GP visit card is about 43%. Okay. So it's much higher than in the levels it was in the 1990s and 2000s. So in terms of policy responses to statutory coverage, essentially in Ireland, there's been changes to all aspects of this over the period of crisis. In terms of the breadth of cover, the biggest change, I suppose, was the reintroduction of means testing for the over 70s in 2009. But then, contrary to that, there's been the recent announcement of the proposed extension of GP visit cards to all those aged 5 and under. In terms of scope, there's been reduction in the types of entitlements that people get under the public system, particularly in terms of other community services. And then there's also been changes to the depth of cover. So there's been introduction of user fees for medical card patients in relation to prescription pharmaceuticals, and then continued increase for non-medical card patients. In terms of sort of policy options and international responses, in terms of the breadth of cover, the international trend is towards increasing coverage, okay, so it's including more people in public system. So, for example, you will see in the Netherlands, for example, the substitute of private health insurance was abolished, and everybody's brought into the sort of the public system in the sense of being able to purchase mandatory insurance. Removing coverage, it does increase the role for private health insurance, and this can exacerbate fiscal pressures if there is tax relief for the purchase of private health insurance. In terms of the scope, this is an issue that has become has received a lot of attention recently in terms of excluding sort of so-called low-value entitlements from the public health system, and health technology assessment obviously has a big role in this regard. But saying that, streamlining the benefits package, it's often technically and probably more importantly politically difficult to achieve, and there's been some recent examples in the Irish context in terms of pharmaceuticals that might be relevant here. And then finally, in terms of depth, so this is in the context of introducing or increasing user fees, the one thing point we would make here is that the usual arguments for user fees do not generally hold in healthcare, and increases or introduction of user fees may conflict with the programme for government objectives. So I'm going to hand over now to Charles, who's going to talk about efficiency and impact on health.
Thank you, Anne. Obviously, the way out of a lot of these dilemmas is potentially if you can get more value out of the same or less resource, you can have the sort of win-win of maintaining or improving access to care, but at the same time achieving some of these efficiencies. And as economists, we're always aware that there are a number of different types of efficiency we're interested in. There are questions about getting the right things and buying appropriate services. There are also questions around ensuring that those are provided and delivered in the most efficient ways. So the issues that we're dealing with here include what to purchase, and Anne's already described the potential difficulties around trying to change the package of services that are available. But who should do the purchasing, and how does that affect the efficiency of the delivery? Who should we be buying from? If you're Ed Walsh, you know that you should be buying only from the private sector, I'm told, because that will ensure that you get everything at half the price, or something related to that, I'm not sure. But to be serious about it, there are questions. Can you get alternative suppliers of service that will provide the same quality or better quality at a lower cost? What prices should be paid? Someone once described BHI to me as an ATM. It was just a way of taking money out and giving it to people. I thought it didn't have that level of technological sophistication. But is the principle of purchasing one that is focused on trying to get good value, or is it simply passing on the funds from the people who provided them to those who receive them? What are the conditions under which the purchasing should take place in terms of what are the expectations? And again, we would be aware that in the Irish context, generally speaking, the funding of hospitals is on the basis that you're funded to be a hospital. And there is a service agreement underneath that, but the degree of specificity there is very slight, and the extent to which you're directly incentivized to provide particular services is therefore very weak. So what are the principles we should be trying to follow? Well, finding ways to match resources most completely to needs, reducing waste and ensuring quality, and setting priorities to ensure that this will be the outcome. Well, what's the current situation in Ireland? Well, purchasing is largely coordinated by the HSE, but they also are a provider, in a direct provider as well as a purchaser of services. And generally speaking, the evidence suggests this is not a terribly good idea to have this mixture of roles, because there is a greater tendency, typically, for organisations that are both users of their own funds and purchasers from elsewhere, for them to protect their own. And there is a good argument against that in the long run being the way things are done. Primary care is paid for, as we know, in a combination of capitation payments, mainly for those with medical card entitlements, or pay-as-you-go on an uncontrolled price basis for the rest of the population. Paying for acute hospitals is, I say, a mixture of direct funding and giving budgets to organisations that are related to a service level agreement, but as I said, relatively weakly as things operate at the moment. There are proposals to reform the delivery structures to bring primary care into team working. And the logic behind that is certainly based on international experience that you can reduce the cost of providing high quality services if you encourage teamwork, bringing in a wider range of healthcare professionals into the delivery process. There are proposals to introduce hospital groups, ultimately leading to trusts, and the idea there is to try and reduce duplication. But interestingly, if you do that, the possibility of encouraging competition between providers of care is reduced, because you're reducing the number of different providers of care. So on one hand, there's a potential to improve efficiency through reducing duplication. On the other hand, that does mean the competitive mechanism for reducing costs is probably undermined. There's also questions looking much more directly at working practices, and there have been changes in that area, for example, looking at people being on duty for much longer periods, or at least covering much longer periods in the day, and not having the 9-to-5 mentality in the delivery of care. So looking at the policy options, paying providers, clearly we know that you can reduce cost in general by shifting from fee for service towards capitation payments. Capitation payments give you a fixed amount, you know in advance what it will be, but also it tends to encourage lower cost provision rather than higher cost. Whereas if you pay for everything you do, obviously there's an advantage in doing more things. I was always like the nice example in Denmark when they introduced a special payment to provide health checks for middle-aged men. And it became unsafe for middle-aged men to walk the streets. They got kidnapped by GPs coming out to drag them in for a health assessment because the incentive to do so was so strong. And they even got some sharing of the profit between the patient and the GP in some instances. So we know that there are some direct relationships between the way in which you pay and the behaviours you get. There are plans to try and integrate across primary, community and acute sectors, and to try and ensure that there is more seamless care and care is provided at the appropriate levels. But there are clearly challenges in doing that at the same time as retaining separate provider systems for the acute and the non-acute care. Input prices are obviously another policy option where you're simply trying to get the same for less. Those of us who remember our salaries 3 or 4 years ago, does anyone dare to think about their salaries 3 or 4 years ago? Because it was so much nicer then. But one of the ways you do it is reducing salaries or reducing pharmaceutical prices. I won't talk about that because of, I'm sure Paul will have much more to say on that. So what has been the impact of the crisis on health? Well, I'm not going to spend very much time on this because David's already given us a lot of the issues around this. We know that the relationships are hard to estimate, partly because of data issues, partly because of time lags in effects, and partly just trying to understand what the causality is, because clearly we know that poverty and health are related to each other, not only in terms of poverty causing ill health, but ill health causing poverty, and so that's obviously a complex relationship. As David said, though, in general, mortality is found to be pro-cyclical, with the exception of suicide. But poor physical health status is found to be pro-cyclical, while poor mental health is typically counter-cyclical. And there are some fairly obvious reasons why that might be the case. But clearly there's a complex relationship between income, unemployment, leisure time, stress, and access to healthcare. Just a little bit of, I think, quite encouraging data here, because in general, the trends in all-cause and cause-specific mortality have been going very much in the right direction. Those of us who have crept into middle age, and those of us who crept a little bit past middle age, are very aware of the fact men are gaining about 2.5 years per decade in life expectancy. So I always tell people when I've lived 10 years, I've only used up about 7.5 of them. And with women, it's less than 2 years per decade, but still very significant. And you see this coming through in these data, that all-cause mortality has been falling, and that is associated with the improved life expectancy. We do see around the mental health and nervous diseases that the trend seems to be slightly in the other direction, but generally speaking, mortality has been falling quite consistently over the last few years. Mortality from external causes, that's accidents and self-harm, you can see again that there have been rises over the early period, but this seems to be now slightly declining or at least holding fairly constant. Interesting, though, if you compare people's self-assessed health, which has been, I think, remarkably stable through the 2007 up till 2011, compared to being satisfied with life. And clearly, the satisfaction with life has gone down very much more than the self-assessed health has over that period. Alcohol and tobacco consumption, again, there are some encouraging trends in this direction. But in both cases, there's been a fall, but much more dramatically so in the case of tobacco than in alcohol. So just in summary, the Irish experience has been of unprecedented reductions in resources in the health sector. And the interesting question is, to what extent has it been possible to protect the quality of services and access to care, and to what extent has this been associated with effects on health? We know that access in terms of the coverage of the public health system has declined quite significantly, as Anne's pointed out, not only in what is covered, but the extent to which it's covered. And we have seen some reductions in use of services that seem to be associated with that. The one thing that I was very struck by on the launch of the Tilda report earlier on in the week was that the direct relationship between obesity in older adults and diabetes is now very clear, not only in terms of just population statistics, but in terms of individuals who were obese in wave one, who are developing diabetes in wave two, suggesting that there may be some specific diseases that we would have to ensure you've got good access if we're going to try and manage down the risks associated with that. Clearly, we've got the backdrop of external and internal pressures in the system. Insofar as the cuts were achieved by reducing the unit costs, that's obviously relatively harmless in terms of the volume and access to care, but insofar as it's been achieved by improving efficiencies, again, there is no direct harm. My estimate is that the rate at which you can generate genuine efficiencies, I mean in input-output terms, not in financial terms, is around 2-3% per year at the fastest, and we probably have tried to exceed that in several of the years. There are so far the cuts might have been largely achieved without harm, but I think there are inevitably concerns that the next round of cuts will do some substantial harm, and the ability to absorb these changes is probably quite little. But at this stage, the preliminary statistics suggest that the effects on health have been, if anything, fairly modest and maybe really have not been felt at all. So we've got further challenges, obviously. How are we going to to confront the next round of required reductions? We've also got the other government initiatives going on at the moment in terms of changing the performance and governance. And the only concern I'd want to raise here specifically is that rapid change in organisations makes it more difficult for them to make the improvements in the operation and efficiency that you're trying to achieve. And making change in difficult times is more difficult than making change in easier times. And it's very important, therefore, to try and maintain the focus.